Welcome back to the Deep Dive, where we take a monumental career, stack up the evidence, and really try to extract the singular story that defines it.
And today we're tackling a big one, a really big one.
We are. We're attempting to map the truly, well, chameleonic landscape that is the career of John Arthur Lithgow.
It is a vast landscape, definitely. I mean, this is a career that just completely defies the kind of boxes we usually put performers in, you know?
Totally. He's 79 now. As of October 2024. And you look at his work, it's not just acting.
No, not at all. It's acting in like every medium imaginable, film, TV, stage.
Plus authorship, music, even poetry.
He's basically a polymath, isn't he? Someone who just refuses to specialize.
Absolutely. And when you look at his accomplishments, it's not just dabbling. He's achieved real mastery in fields most actors wouldn't even, well, attempt.
Right. Think about it. He's the goofy alien commander from Third Rock.
Dick Solomon. Yeah. Hilarious. But then he's also Arthur Mitchell, the Trinity killer.
Terrifying. Wow. Utterly terrifying. And then he's Winston Churchill.
A revered historical figure. And on top of all that, he might genuinely be your kid's favorite author. It's kind of mind bending.
All wrapped up in one, you know, extremely tall package.
Yeah, he is tall, isn't he?
But that kind of versatility, it only really matters if the quality holds up across the board, right?
And with Lithgow, it absolutely does. The quality is, well, it's certified. You just look at the awards.
Exactly. The institutional acclaim is undeniable. We're talking, what, a total of 6 primetime Emmy Awards?
6 Emmys. 2 Golden Globes, 2 Tonys, the big ones for Broadway.
And a Laurence Olivier Award from London's West End, plus 4 Drama Desk Awards.
It's incredible. That means he's hit the absolute top tier in American TV comedy, American TV drama, Broadway theater, and London theater.
It's astonishing consistency across different forms and, frankly, different countries' theatrical traditions.
And the nominations, they tell an even broader story about just how far his reach extends.
Oh, yeah. 2 Academy Award nominations for film.
A BAFTA nomination, too.
Right. British Academy Film Award. 4 Grammy nominations. That's for his music and spoken word stuff.
Which is a whole other area we need to get into.
And 4 Screen Actors Guild Awards nominations as well from his peers.
So this isn't just, you know, a talented actor. This is a genuine cultural powerhouse.
Mm.
Someone whose success just translates seemingly effortlessly across every single form of media.
And that's what's really fascinating here, isn't it? That's the core of our deep dive today. How does he do it? How does he manage those extreme pivots
from high art to pop culture and back again?
Yeah, moving so smoothly between really demanding intellectual work, think Shakespeare on stage, like King Lear,
right? Very highbrow.
And then, you know, huge populous entertainment, animated movies, network sitcoms, family comedies.
Our mission then is to try and connect these dots, these seemingly completely separate parts of his career,
and trace how maybe his intellectual, his academic foundation actually provided the structure that allowed him to master pretty much every genre he decided to touch.
From really sharp political satire
to these incredibly sensitive, deep character studies.
That intellectual foundation does sound key. Yeah. So, okay, let's unpack this. Let's start right at the beginning. The roots. What gave him this remarkable discipline, this flexibility we see throughout his career?
Indeed. Let's go back. John Lithgow, born October 19, 1945, Rochester, New York. But his world was theatrical from, well, from day one.
Born into it.
Pretty much. His father, Arthur Lithgow, was a highly regarded theatrical producer, director too, probably best known for running the McCarter Theater in Princeton, New Jersey, a very prestigious place.
And his mother?
His mother, Sarah Jane, was a retired actress herself.
So, wow, he wasn't just aware of the theater. He was practically raised backstage.
Exactly. You can picture it, right? The kid doing his homework in the wings while, I don't know, Chekhov is being rehearsed on stage.
He lived and breathed it.
The family absolutely did. And his childhood, it was really defined by movement and observation, essential tools for any great character actor, right?
Constantly adapting.
Because his father's job meant they moved around a lot, frequently. And this is where we get some of those really surprising, almost, wait, what? Anecdotes?
Okay, yeah, lay them on us. The Coretta Scott King one still blows my mind every time I hear it.
It's genuinely remarkable, isn't it? A real historical footnote. It just illuminates the kind of intellectual and socially engaged environment he was growing up in.
So where was this?
They lived for a time in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And yes, the activist Coretta Scott King was actually his babysitter.
Just imagine that. The conversations, the atmosphere, the proximity to major historical figures during your formative years. It's incredible.
It really speaks volumes about the circles his family moved in. Not just theater people, but, you know, plugged into the broader currents of American thought and activism at the time.
So it wasn't just Yellow Springs.
No, he also spent time in other places. They lived at Stan Hywood Hall in Akron for a while.
Wow, the former Cyberling estate. That's amazing.
Yeah, and then Lakewood, Ohio, before the family finally settled more permanently in Princeton.
All that moving around, it must have demanded a huge amount of adaptability from him as a kid.
You'd have to think so. Constantly assessing new environments, new people, new social dynamics, new expectations. It's actually perfect training, in a way, for someone who would later need to inhabit dozens of completely different characters.
Makes sense. And that adaptability, that intelligence, it clearly extended to his schoolwork. His academic record is, well, seriously impressive.
Oh, definitely. After graduating from Princeton High School in 63, he went straight to Harvard College.
And studied.
History and English literature. So we're talking a classical, rigorous, liberal arts education.
And he wasn't just coasting either.
Not at all. This wasn't a casual degree. He graduated in 1967 with an AB Magna Cum Laude.
Which means with great distinction.
Exactly. And he was elected to Phi Beta Kappa, the Academic Honor Society, this intellectual firepower, this deep dive into narrative, history, human motivation. You feel like that's the unseen engine driving his versatility later on.
He didn't just learn how to act. He learned why people act the way they do.
Precisely. And that connection to academia, it stuck with him. He even served on the Harvard Board of Overseers later in life.
So he's got this brilliant academic mind.
Yeah.
What was the moment, the spark, that really turned this history scholar towards being a full-time performer? Was there a specific point?
He actually credits a specific student performance he did at Harvard. It was a production of Gilbert and Sullivan's Utopia Limited.
A comedic operetta.
Interesting. Yeah, apparently doing that, experiencing the joy of that kind of performance, it just crystallized his decision. This is what he wanted to do.
But he didn't just, you know, pack his bags for New York right away.
No, characteristically, he doubled down on training first. Classical training. He won a Fulbright scholarship.
Why?
Which allowed him to go study across the pond at the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Art, LMDA.
Which is one of the top acting conservatories in the world.
Absolutely. So that path is really crucial, I think. First, the intellectual rigor of Harvard, then the classical stagecraft of LMDA.
That combination, it gives you an actor who can handle incredibly stylized farce, but with, like, surgical precision, and also deep drama.
Right. And even after LMDA, he didn't rush things. Before he hit Broadway, he actually served as the director of the Arts and Literature Department at WBAI.
The Pacifica radio station in New York.
That's the one, which shows this early interest in, like, curating and administering culture, not just performing it. He had this broader, holistic view of the arts world from the start.
Okay. Before we jump into his professional career taking off, we absolutely have to mention that other wild factoid.
The genealogical stuff.
Oh, yeah. The finding your roots discoveries. It's truly astonishing.
So he finds out he's a direct descendant of how many Mayflower passengers?
Eight. Eight Mayflower passengers, including William Bradford, the colonial governor.
So his roots go right back to the literal beginning of the American historical narrative.
It's incredible. And if that wasn't enough,
there's more. The findings also showed he's related to the show's host, Henry Louis Gates Jr., and he's distant cousins with this unbelievable roster of American cultural figures.
Like who?
Okay, get this. Chef Julia Child.
Wow.
The famously reclusive author Thomas Pynchon.
No way. Pynchon.
Yeah. And actors like Alec Baldwin, Clint Eastwood, and Sally Field.
That is an insane collection of relatives.
It really is. And if you pause for a second and kind of connect this surprising lineage to his career, maybe it starts to make a strange sort of sense.
How so?
Well, he literally contains this huge swath of American cultural history within his family tree, right? From pilgrims and governors to celebrity chefs, literary enigmas, Hollywood icons.
So you're saying inhabiting all these different American personas.
Yeah.
From the highbrow intellectual to the, you know, deeply populist entertainer. Mm. It's almost like a birthright for him.
Maybe. It suggests he has both the intellectual grounding and this kind of deep, almost familial connection to play all these different American cultural roles authentically.
Hmm. Interesting angle. Speaking of authenticity, let's trace his rise. Starting with the stage, which really feels like the core of his artistic identity, doesn't it?
Absolutely. The thespian core.
So we're looking at roughly 1972 to 1995. this period where he just dominates Broadway almost immediately and then gets massive film recognition.
His professional launch was, frankly, explosive. Made his Broadway debut in 73, David Story's play, The Changing Room.
And the reaction?
Immediate. Overwhelming. He won his very first Tony Award right there. Best featured actor in a play. And a Drama Desk Award, too.
For his debut, that's incredibly rare. It just signals that all that training, Harvard, LMDA, the radio work, it paid off instantly. The discipline was there.
Totally. And that success kept him focused on the stage initially. He did major work in other plays like My Fat Friend opposite Lynn Redgrave.
And more Tony nominations followed.
Yep. He was nominated again in 1985 for Requiem for a Heavyweight. That was written by Rod Serling, actually.
Wow, the Twilight Zone creator.
The very same. Then came that critically acclaimed run in M. Butterfly in 1988 opposite B.D. Wong. Got another Tony nomination for that.
So the stage wasn't just a launch pad. It was his anchor. His home base.
Absolutely. But while he was conquering Broadway, he was also quietly building this parallel career in film. And that really exploded in the early 80s.
What was the turning point there?
Well, his film debut was actually 72 in a movie called Dealing, or the Berkeley to Boston 40 Brick Lost Bag Blues. Bit of a mouthful.
Yeah, just rolls off the tongue.
But he gained serious traction playing a character based loosely on the choreographer Michael Bennett in Bob Fosse's All That Jazz in 1979.
Oh, right. Great film. Intense.
Super intense. And that role alone showed he could handle Fosse's really complex mix of, you know, musicality, drama, psychological depth.
And this leads us right into the period that cemented his screen credibility. Those back-to-back Oscar nominations.
Yeah, it's such a testament to his range that these nominations came for two completely different kinds of performances, both emotionally rich, but so distinct.
First one was 82, The World, according to Garp.
Playing Roberta Muldoon, the transgender ex-football player.
A groundbreaking role for its time, surely. Especially in mainstream film.
Absolutely. It demanded incredible sensitivity, real emotional honesty. He had to portray this character who was, let's face it, often misunderstood or even caricatured back then.
How did he manage to make it so moving, so sensitive, rather than, you know, playing it for laughs or shock value?
I think it comes back to that intellectual approach, that respect for the character's complexity. He approached Roberta as a fully realized human being, focused on her internal life, her dignity, not just the external transformation.
And the nomination itself was a huge validation of that nuanced approach.
Definitely. It showed he could access that profound emotional depth right away on screen.
And then, incredibly, he follows that up the very next year, 1983, with another nomination.
Second consecutive nod for Best Supporting Actor, this time for Terms of Endearment.
Playing Sam Burns, the quiet, lonely banker who has the affair with Debra Winger's character. No, Shirley MacLaine's character.
Right. Shirley MacLaine's character, Emma, he provides this sort of quiet, grounded counterpoint to her chaotic life.
That contrast is just amazing. From the pioneering, life-altering journey of Roberta Muldoon.
To the understated, almost mundane, relatable sadness of Sam Burns.
Those two roles back-to-back, they really cemented his reputation, didn't they? As this dynamic, emotionally articulate, super reliable screen actor, no matter the genre.
Totally. He could do anything. And the rest of the 80s proved it. It was like an absolute genre playground for him, just showcasing that ability to jump between high art and, well, pure, sometimes frantic entertainment.
Okay, so let's talk about that 80s run. Yeah. Where does he go after the Oscar nods?
Well, the transition from respected nominee to genuine horror icon happened pretty quickly. 1983, Twilight Zone, the movie.
Oh, yes. Nightmare at 20,000 Feet. The gremlin on the wing.
He plays that terrified passenger, John Valentine. And his performance is just sheer, unadulterated psychological terror. It's riveting.
He actually said in an interview, I think, with Bill Moyers, that this was his favorite film role he ever did.
And that tells you so much, doesn't it? He loves roles that demand that total, almost unhinged commitment to a specific psychological state. The anxiety, the manic energy he sustains, it's incredible.
Then, the very next year, 1984, he delivers maybe the ultimate high-camp sci-fi villain performance.
Dr. Emilio Lizardo / Lord John Worfen.
In The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai Across the Eighth Dimension.
An absolute cult classic. And that performance is the polar opposite of the contained terror in Twilight Zone.
Totally. It's bizarre. It's over the top.
Slightly cartoonish, maybe?
Yeah.
But delivered with absolute unwavering commitment. He just goes for it. It proves he understands perfectly when a performance needs to lean into theatricality, into absurdism.
He was also in a more mainstream sci-fi film that same year, wasn't he?
Yeah, the big sequel, 2010, The Year We Make Contact, played Dr. Walter Kernow. More grounded, but still in that sci-fi realm.
And we can't forget, even amidst the genre stuff, he was still touching on serious themes. That minor but impactful role in The Day After.
Right, 1983, the TV movie about nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah.
Huge cultural event at the time.
And he got an Emmy nomination for that, even for a smaller part. Shows his ability to contribute meaningfully to serious social commentary.
And this period also loops back to his early radio experience. Remember WBAI?
Oh, yeah. How so?
He voiced Yoda.
Get out! Really?
Yep, in the classic NTR radio drama adaptations of The Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi.
That's fantastic. What a great piece of trivia. It shows his versatility, again, using just his voice to create such an iconic character.
Exactly. Not relying on visuals at all. Pure vocal performance.
Okay, so as we move out of the 80s and into the 90s, his villainous streak, it seems to continue, maybe even intensify. Especially in action and thrillers.
Absolutely. He really embraced playing the dangerous antagonist. In 91, he was terrifying opposite Denzel Washington in Ricochet. Played the criminal Earl Talbot Blake.
Vicious role.
Really nasty. Then came the Brian De Palma thriller Raising Kane in 92.
Where he played a guy with multiple personality disorder.
Right. Which, for an actor like him, is like a gift, isn't it? Allowed him to explore several distinct characters within one physical body. A real acting showcase.
And then the big one. The blockbuster action villain role.
Eric Quaylen, the sophisticated, ruthless terrorist leader in Cliffhanger.
Opposite Stallone, 1993. High altitude thrills. He was the perfect 90s bad guy. Intelligent, articulate, but utterly without mercy.
He really nailed that archetype. But even amidst all the action and thrills, the weight of history pulls him back again, connecting to that academic background.
How so this time?
1994. He portrays President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR.
Wow. And what?
An NBC miniseries called World War II, When Lions Roared, starred alongside Michael Caine as Stalin and Bob Hoskins as Churchill. Talk about a heavyweight cast.
That's huge. Tackling FDR, that's stepping into massive historical shoes. Mm-hmm. How did he prepare for a role like that? An icon everyone recognizes.
Immense commitment, both physically and historically. To mirror FDR's paralysis from polio, Lithgow actually wore these heavy, cumbersome leg braces throughout the filming.
That kind of physical transformation, we see it again later with Churchill. He's not afraid of the practical discomfort if it helps embody the character.
Exactly. And he spoke about the pressure, too. The weight of playing such a revered figure. He mentioned that when he told his mother he got the role, she apparently burst into tears.
Wow. Just shows the emotional significance it held, even within his own family.
So that ability to handle intense prep, high expectations, deep historical context, that really sets the stage perfectly for his next phase, the phase where he becomes a true household name, an established icon across all mediums.
Right. Let's pivot now to that period, say, 1996 through to about 2015.
Okay. And this phase really kicks off with a role that, for a whole generation of TV viewers, is John Lithgow.
Dr. Dick Solomon.
Dr. Dick Solomon, high commander of the alien expedition, NBC sitcom Third Rock from the Sun, ran from 96 to 2001.
It was such a bizarre concept, but it worked brilliantly. Aliens trying, and mostly failing, to understand basic human life.
And his performance. It required this incredible amount of physical comedy, really stylized movements, big facial expressions, a complete 180 from the contained menace of Quallen or Blake.
You really see the stage training coming through there, don't you?
Absolutely. That kind of high-level physical comedy, it needs incredible precision, timing, control, stamina. His serious theater background actually enabled him to pull off the manic, exaggerated movements of an alien commander who's, like, piloting a human body he doesn't quite understand.
And the awards voters noticed. Big time.
Yeah, yeah. Six consecutive Emmy nominations for Outstanding Lead Actor in a Comedy Series. Every single year the show is on the air.
And he won three times, right?
Three wins. 1996, 1997, and 1999. It's genuinely hard to think of another actor who made that specific pivot so successfully.
From two back-to-back dramatic Oscar nominations.
To winning three Emmys in 4 years for this wild, high-concept physical comedy. It's just extraordinary range.
And wasn't his son on the show, too?
Yeah, just a nice little detail. His son, Ian Lithgow, appeared regularly as Leon, one of Dick's physics students.
Nice. Okay, so hot on the heels of Third Rock wrapping up 2001 comes this voice acting role that became, well, unexpectedly massive.
Totally massive. And apparently nobody saw it coming, least of all Lithgow himself.
Lord Farquaad.
Lord Farquaad, the diminutive, power-hungry, hilarious villain in DreamWorks Shrek.
And the story behind that is pretty funny, right?
Yeah, the anecdote is great. It really reveals how much the animation landscape was changing then. Lithgow admitted he initially just thought it was, quote, like a Saturday morning cartoon, you know, not a big deal.
He didn't realize it would be a phenomenon.
Not at all. Because the production took so long with lots of delays, he apparently just came back once every 8 months or so to record some new material. He had no idea it was going to become this global mega hit.
But his vocal performance was instantly iconic. Critics loved it.
They did. They often compared his delivery, that kind of delicious, sophisticated, slightly theatrical villainy, to actors like Kelsey Grammer or Alan Rickman, masters of the voice.
He managed to convey all that arrogance, the pettiness, the ambition, just through his voice. Incredible.
But even while conquering TV comedy and blockbuster animation, the stage was always calling him back. It remained his artistic center.
So he returns to Broadway.
In 2002. And proves he can handle musical theater, too. He wins his second Tony Award.
Second Tony, this time for
Best Leading Actor in a Musical for Sweet Smell of Success.
Playing J.J. Hunsaker, the cynical, powerful newspaper columnist.
Right, a character worlds away from Dick Solomon.
Mm-hmm.
Deeply bitter, manipulative, dark.
How demanding is that switch? Going from that high-energy sitcom grind to carrying a complex musical drama like that.
It requires completely different muscles, artistically speaking. Hunsaker needed serious vocal control for the songs, that dramatic gravitas for the character, and the sheer physical discipline of doing 8 shows a week in a musical.
His dedication to theater just shines through. He got another nomination soon after, didn't he?
Yeah. A few years later, 2005, for the musical comedy Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Though in a fun twist, he actually lost the Tony that year to his co-star, Norbert Leo Butz.
Still, that commitment to the stage was formally recognized around then, too.
Yes. He was inducted into the American Theater Hall of Fame in 2005, which acknowledged not just his work in straight plays, but also his surprising work in opera. He had performed in productions by Verdi and Wagner.
Opera, too. Is there anything he can't do?
Apparently not. And that same year, 2005, really highlights that unique blend he has, the performer and the intellectual.
Oh, so.
He went back to his alma mater, Harvard, and became the first actor ever invited to deliver the main commencement speech.
Wow. That's usually reserved for presidents, Nobel laureates, CEOs.
Exactly. It was a huge honor. And Harvard also gave him an honorary Doctor of Arts degree that day.
Okay, so we've got the lovable alien, the Broadway star, the respected intellectual.
Hmm.
And then, just as maybe audiences were getting comfortable with that image, he delivered a performance so chilling, it completely redefined his dramatic side for a whole new generation.
The Trinity Killer.
Arthur Mitchell. Dexter Morgan's terrifying nemesis in the 2009 season of Dexter.
This role, maybe more than any other single role, just shattered whatever lingering public perception there was of John Lithgow as primarily a comedic actor.
It showed he could harness that quiet intensity we saw way back in terms of Endearment or even Raising Cain.
But infuse it with this deep, chilling, terrifying malice.
The horror of Arthur Mitchell was that duality, wasn't it? The outwardly normal, pious family man, the Sunday school teacher.
Who was secretly this meticulous, realistic serial killer, operating completely under the radar for decades.
His performance was a masterclass in controlled menace.
Total containment. His approach felt almost clinical, highlighting the structure, the control that Arthur Mitchell exerted over his double life. And it resonated so deeply because it tapped into that fear of the ordinary turning monstrous, the monster next door.
And again, the awards followed. A Golden Globe for this role.
Yep. Golden Globe Award. And another Primetime Emmy Award, this time for Outstanding Guest Actor in a Drama Series. He even came back briefly for the revival series in 2021.
You want the ultimate career contrast. Just put those Emmy wins side by side.
Right. The triple Emmy winning manic physical comedy of Dick Solomon.
And the Globe, an Emmy-winning, tightly controlled, psychopathic terror of Arthur Mitchell.
It perfectly illustrates the whole point of this deep dive, doesn't it? His chameleonic talent isn't just superficial. It's about diving deep into the psychological structure of a character, whether that character operates on, you know, comedic alien logic or pure cold sociopathy.
But this era wasn't all just dark TV drama. He kept the stage work going, too.
Absolutely. He maintained that theatrical commitment, played the big one, Shakespeare's King Lear. title role.
Where was that?
In 2014 at Shakespeare in the Park in New York, which was actually his first time performing there since way back in 1975, a big return.
And he was still championing smaller independent films too, right?
Yes, showing his support for complex, character-driven indie filmmaking. Around that same time, 2014, he got a lot of critical attention for his role opposite Alfred Molina in Love is Strange.
Oh, I remember that film. Oh. Beautifully done. Mm. About an older gay couple facing difficulties after finally getting married.
Exactly. It got great reviews, something like 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, 4 Independent Spirit Award nominations. Critics really praised the graceful, sensitive portrayal of this long-term relationship by both him and Molina.
It just shows that his star power, his recognizability, could help elevate these smaller, important films alongside the big blockbusters and hit TV shows.
It confirms that pattern we see throughout his career. He seems to use the visibility and, frankly, the financial success from his TV and film work to sustain and enable the more demanding, often less commercial artistic work that clearly feeds his curiosity, like stage work or indie film.
Which brings us neatly into his most recent phase, say 2016 to the present. This period feels marked by incredibly high prestige projects, a lot of historical transformation, and even direct political commentary.
Definitely. And the role that really defined this later career prestige, especially for the huge global streaming audiences, has to be Winston Churchill.
In Netflix's The Crown, season 1, 2016.
Right. And for this, bang, another Primetime Emmy Award. And a Screen Actors Guild Award, too, outstanding supporting actor in a drama series for both.
Taking on Churchill, that's maybe even bigger than FDR. So many iconic portrayals already exist. You're inviting constant comparison. How did he approach it?
He said he had no hesitation about taking the role, which is pretty bold. But he did his homework, extensive research, reading biographies, watching archival footage, listening to speeches.
But the physical transformation must have been immense.
Oh, huge. That was perhaps the most challenging part. He apparently spent 2 full days just getting fitted for the necessary fat suit, the wig, and even these special mouth plumpers.
Mouth plumpers. To change his speech.
Exactly. Designed to help mimic Churchill's very specific cadence and diction, the slight jowliness.
That level of commitment to physical alteration, it's a hallmark of his work, isn't it?
Hmm.
He's not afraid of the makeup chair, the prosthetics, the discomfort, if it helps him find the character's essence.
Totally. And the performance itself was lauded because it wasn't just imitation, it was layered. He captured not just the famous wartime leader's bombast and strength,
but also the complexities.
Yeah, the vulnerability of a great man aging, grappling with potential irrelevance after the war, battling his black dog, his depression. It felt like a performance rooted, again, in that deep understanding of history and psychology, thanks to that academic background.
And around the same time, we see this other fascinating shift. Lithgow, the intellectual, the observer, starts moving into direct political satire, using his art to comment on the contemporary American scene.
Which is pretty unusual for an actor of his stature and generation, right?
Yes.
To be so overtly topical.
Very. So what form did this take?
Well, he authored books. 2 books of satirical poems focused squarely on the Trump administration.
Really? Poetry?
Yep. Mm. Dumpty. The Age of Trump in Verse came out in 2019. It was actually a bestseller hit number 3 on the New York Times hardcover nonfiction list.
Wow.
And then he followed it up with Trumpty Dumpty Wanted a Crown in 2020.
He didn't just write, though. He used performance, too, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. He played Donald Trump in a live reading of excerpts from the Mueller report in 2019. It was called The Investigation, A Search for the Truth in 10X.
And he became a fixture on late-night TV for a while.
Portraying Rudy Giuliani. In a whole series of recurring sketches on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, he completely nailed Giuliani's mannerisms around that time.
He also lent his voice to that parody children's book.
Right, the audiobook version of A Day in the Life of Marlon Brando, the book that gently satirized Mike Pence's Family Rabbit book by telling a story about a gay rabbit.
So he's really putting his recognizable voice and versatile talents right into the middle of immediate cultural and political conversations.
Fearlessly, it seems. But shifting back to more traditional dramatic roles, he took on another really complex, controversial figure from the political media world.
Roger Ailes.
Roger Ailes, yeah. The Fox News CEO, in the 2019 film Bombshell.
Another figure who inspired intense loyalty from some and utter condemnation from others. How did Lithgow approach that minefield?
He was very clear about his intention. He stated publicly that his goal with the portrayal was specifically, quote, to trouble people, unsettle people with the fact that they shouldn't have sympathy for the devil.
Hmm. So he wasn't trying to find the good in Ailes.
Doesn't sound like it. It shows an actor really thinking about the narrative impact, the moral responsibility of portraying someone so powerful and polarizing. He wanted the audience to confront the difficult reality of the man's actions, not find easy empathy.
And he's kept up this incredible pace of high-profile dramatic work just in the last few years.
Absolutely. He was great as the sort of fading old guard lawyer, Elias Burchard, E.B. Jonathan in HBO's Perry Mason reboot back in 2020.
And then he starred opposite Jeff Bridges in that excellent Hulu thriller, The Old Man, in 2022.
Right, playing the FBI assistant director, Harold Harper. Got another Golden Globe nomination for that. His ability to just anchor these prestige streaming dramas, often playing these morally complex, ambiguous characters, shows his appeal is still incredibly strong with top-tier creators.
And he popped up in Scorsese's huge epic.
Yep, joined the incredible cast of Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon in 2023. Playing Prosecutor Leeward.
And just recently, in 2024, another intriguing film role.
Conclave, the conspiracy thriller set during a papal election. He plays one of the cardinals, Cardinal Tremblay. Critics called his performance intriguingly slippery.
So he still has that capacity for subtle, unpredictable menace when he needs it.
Seems so. And we're still seeing him triumph on the global stage, too. Just this year, 2024, he won the Laurence Olivier Award for Best Actor.
London's highest theater honor.
For what role?
For portraying the author Roald Dahl in the West End production of a play called Giant. Wow. Another major award, late in his career. It just confirms his stage vitality is completely undiminished.
And critics apparently noted his uncanny resemblance to the writer in the role, that physical transformation again.
And looking even further ahead, he's not slowing down. He's stepping into another absolutely iconic, generation-defining role soon.
It was confirmed just recently, February 2025, I believe. He's going to play Albus Dumbledore.
Dumbledore. In the new HBO Harry Potter series.
That is a massive role. Huge cultural weight. Immense expectations from fans.
It solidifies his presence across yet another generation of popular culture, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Kids who read his children's books. Adults who watch Third Rock or The Crown.
Mm-hmm.
They'll all engage with his work in this new, iconic way.
It's an amazing capstone, potentially. Though knowing him, probably not the final one.
Probably not.
Mm.
Okay, before we try to wrap our heads around this whole staggering career, we absolutely have to touch on his completely separate creative life. The thing that really marks him as a Renaissance man.
His work for children.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It often gets overshadowed by the acting awards, but he's a genuinely prolific and successful children's author.
He really is. He's written and sometimes illustrated several bestsellers. Books like Marsupial Sue, Macabre, I'm a Manatee, the remarkable Farkle McBride.
And these aren't just quick celebrity cash-ins, are they? They feel like thoughtful, often funny contributions to children's literature, often celebrating creativity, music.
Precisely. And that dedication extends to performing music for children, too. He released 3 albums of kids' music.
I remember Singing in the Bathtub from 1999.
Yeah, that was the first one. Then Farkle and Friends in 2002, he dedicated that one to the country singer Waylon Jennings, oddly enough.
Unexpected.
And The Sunny Side of the Street in 2006. And he actually performs these songs sometimes, makes appearances accompanying himself on guitar.
What's truly unique, though, maybe the absolute peak of his bizarrely diverse artistic life, is the ballet connection.
It's unparalleled for an actor, surely. He wrote the narrations for a ballet by the choreographer, Christopher Wheeldon. It's called Carnival of the Animals.
Based on the Sansons music.
Exactly. But not only did he write the narration, he actually performed in the ballet with major companies like the New York City Ballet.
Doing what? Not dancing, surely.
Oh, no, not plies. He played a character, an elephant named Nurse Mabel Bunce, which required him to blend like physical comedy, narration, and somehow engage with high art ballet choreography all at once.
Okay, that intersection right there, Oscar nominee, sitcom star, Shakespearean leave, political satirist, children's author, and ballet elephant. That might just be the perfect summation of John Lithgow's versatility.
It's pretty close. And just briefly, on the personal and professional recognition side beyond the performance awards, he has a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. He's in the American Theater Hall of Fame.
And reflecting that intellectual side again, he was elected to the American Philosophical Society in 2019.
Right. Very prestigious. Shows his deep engagement with ideas beyond just performance. And personally, he's been married to Mary Yeager, a UCLA history professor, since 1981.
Long marriage.
Yeah. He has 3 children, one from his first marriage to Jean Tayton, which ended back in 1980.
Okay, so we have cataloged this career of just staggering, almost dizzying diversity. Stage triumphs, Oscar drama, blockbuster action, triple Emmy comedy, high prestige history, political satire, children's books, music, ballet.
Where do you even begin to summarize it? I think John Lithgow's career is basically the definition of a masterclass in adaptation. His success isn't defined by just one thing, one medium, one genre.
No.
It's defined by his unique ability to reach the absolute highest levels in wildly different arenas, conquering the stage, whether it's classic Shakespeare like Lear or winning an Olivier for playing Roald Dahl.
While simultaneously dominating television in roles that could not be more different from each other.
He just refuses to be put in a box, refuses to be contained by any single creative label.
And that profound chameleonic nature, maybe is best understood, as we touched on, by just revisiting the sheer emotional distance between those three key Emmy-winning TV roles.
It's the perfect illustration. You've got Dick Solomon, hyper-physical, manic, but incredibly disciplined comedic timing, an alien leader.
Then you got Arthur Mitchell, the Trinity Killer. Terrifyingly controlled, psychologically complex, pure contained menace. A serial killer.
And then Winston Churchill, nuanced, complex, revered, burdened, a historical icon.
He achieved top-tier, award-winning success embodying three completely different modes of human or, well, alien experience.
It really does raise a fundamental question, doesn't it? A provocative one, maybe, for all of us. We live in a world, especially now, that seems to reward narrow focus, specialization, building a personal brand around one thing.
Right. Find your niche and stick to it.
But Lithgow achieved success at the highest levels, in the most demanding roles, across comedy, drama, film, stage, literature. Precisely because he refused to limit himself. He constantly sought reinvention.
So what does his career, this massive spectrum of accomplishment, suggest about the actual value of refusing to specialize? About the power of remaining adaptable and curious across disciplines?
Maybe it suggests that true mastery can come from breadth as well as depth. Something to think about.
A profound thought indeed. Something for you, our listeners, to carry forward long after this deep dive ends. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks, everyone.
We'll see you next time on The Deep Dive.